listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2026 Vuelta a España. On the ground and on the road from Monaco to Granada.
I should commit.
You pull with everyone except with me.
You put me so much like this.
Thanks, man.
I should commit. Sorry.
No. Do you have a bottle any chance or some of the 20s? My little boy would love it.
Oh wow, look, Josh.
First high five.
Oh, that's amazing. Good job, man.
Nice job. Okay,
Blair, was it here?
Thank you. Yeah, you too.
Bonsoir, Michele Pelacci.
Bonsoir, Daniele.
This is our third attempt now at the start of the recording.
Because we are in a parking lot in France. What a strange place for the Vuelta a España, right?
Indeed, Pelacci. And not our fault that this is take three. It's the fault of all the cars, the traffic, the bus drivers, everyone else around us. Is that not the case, Pelacci? Anyway, What did we hear at the start of today's third take? Well, we heard one of these wonderful moments that we get to capture when we're here on the ground covering these races, Michele. Tadej Pogacar, Wout van Aert, very much protagonist in today's stage, at the end of today's stage, and a moment between them. They shared a bit of a moment, crossing paths, and then Wout van Aert sort of shouted out to Pogacar, "Tadej, old son." Well, we heard it, didn't we? How come you don't work with me? You work with everyone, but with me, and we'll talk more about this later in the episode. Then, well, we had a bit of a, it wasn't a mean comment, Pelacci, it wasn't a barbed comment, it was a very jovial comment, in fact. Then we saw a very jovial moment, Wout van Aert asking Pogacar for a bottle for his son Jules, who was there, Jules being delighted, as you would be, and then a high five between Pogacar and Wout van Aert, and it was a lovely moment. And Pelacci, one thing I will say, and I sort of thought about this overnight, after the end of yesterday's time trial, we saw a moment between Josh Tarling and Tadej Pogacar yesterday, and Pogacar really making a point of sort of comforting him. We kind of know the whole backstory, we don't need to go back over that, but it was another moment after today's stage, which I know that some people, and it's legitimate to have certain misgivings about certain things with Pogacar dominating the sport, it's legitimate to have misgivings about anyone who's dominating this particular sport because of the history of it, it's legitimate to have misgivings about sponsors of teams in this sport, people involved with sponsors of teams, people involved with teams themselves, but Pogacar in just his micro behaviours, Pelacci, is pretty exemplary.
What a classy chap Pogacar is. Again, had an example today. Lovely, lovely rider. And I love the fact that he got into the challenge for the stage today again. He didn't have to. I think he did it just because he was challenged again. Because, as we will see, the first rider who opened up, who fired up the stage with 2K to go was Wout van Aert. Two of the best riders in the world.
Indeed. We're not going to analyze it too much now, are we? Because the analysis part of the podcast, of course, is part two. But actually, this is the scene setting part of the podcast. Yeah. We've sort of referred to the fact that we're in a fairly sort of unsalubrious location for a podcast recording. Yesterday, we talked about Jean Genot, and I expected us to be in the shadow of the Montagne de Loire, beautiful Provençal tableau landscape. I expected that to be the backdrop for our recording tonight, but not the case.
You're in a scorching hot parking lot.
Yes.
Amazing location.
Amazing. I mentioned the landscape. Pelacci, I was standing with you, close to the finish line, and I remarked on what a gorgeous, very easy on the eye stage today's was. And again, you seem very sheepish about this. Sort of a typical Italian kind of poo-pooing the French landscape. So you sort of, yeah, it was all right. It was all right.
I would rather have
been in Lombardia.
Oh yeah, of course. Well, not that's my least favorite region out of 20 in Italy, but not impressed by France today. You see motorbikes. We're in a parking lot, Daniele. Why are we here? I don't know. But I must say, Manosque has history, has lavender fields around it, has trees, has hills. It could be worse.
It could be worse. And it could have been worse this morning, couldn't it, Pelacci? Because we were in certainly a glamorous location, certainly more glamorous than now this morning, because we were down in the port in Monaco, Monte Carlo. This is the sort of places that we frequent nowadays. But of course, the Vuelta a España was starting in Monte Carlo today, or stage two of the Vuelta a España was starting in Monte Carlo after today's time trial in Monaco. And the talk this morning Pelacci was of Pogacar, obviously having the red jersey, but also several riders, it was a pretty close run thing yesterday, several riders being in with a chance of taking that red jersey off Pogacar this morning. Pelacci, several riders in with a chance of taking red. Just give us a quick reminder. Usually we'll put this in the prosciutometer, but give me a quick reminder of what the standings were this morning.
It was Pogacar above everyone else, as he usually does, in the red jersey. At the same time of him, no gaps were created by the TT, Ethan Hayter, 4 seconds down, Joshua Tarling, 5 seconds down, Callum Torley, and then via via. That's what we see in Italian.
Well, most importantly, we had Christophe Laporte, because Visma Lisa Bike had three riders who theoretically could have taken the red jersey today. We had Laporte, who was six seconds down. Then we had Wout van Aert, who was 9 seconds down. And we had Matthew Brennan, who a lot of people fancied to win today's stage, 16th. And he was 16 seconds down with the bonus seconds on offer. In theory, even Brennan could have taken the red jersey. But another question that actually was, was Pogacar himself going to go for stage win number two today? This is what Mads Pedersen, another of the favourites for today's stage, said this morning in Monaco about that eventuality. Pogacar going for the stage win today in Manosque.
It's today, man. Like, actually, that's a stupid question almost. I thought you could do better than this.
I'm not that guy tired after the Tour de France.
No, but like today he wants to win today as well, you know. It's a stage that suits him. The final suits him. He can also sprint. So I'm 100% sure that we will see them pull and try to win the stage also.
Well, Pelacci, that was very interesting. Pedersen saying, well, of course he's going to go for it because it's Pogacar. I'd sort of talked myself out of that possibility. When I first saw the profiles of this stage two of the Vuelta a España, I thought that it might suit Pogacar. I must confess, I didn't have a very clear memory of the stages of the Tour de la Provence that had finished in Manosque, but certainly the last 2 or 3 kilometres were predominantly uphill, so I wondered as well. But then in recent days I'd persuaded myself otherwise, and I thought, nah, no chance is he going to go for it. But we were about to find out that he did indeed go for stage win number two today in Manosque. Pelacci, now you're going to give us your hamonometro and tell us what did indeed happen on today's stage.
El hamonometro de Michele Pelacci.
Pelacci, how many jamones?
I'm going to
how many jambon today? It's jambon today.
3 jamones, Daniele. No, we had a great final, yes, but it was just too little, too slow to ramp up in the final because we only had 2 fantastic kilometers out of more than 200, right? So 3 jamones is pretty solid, right?
I think that's very parsimonious. I think that is not very generous, Pelacci, given that you gave yesterday's 9 kilometer time trial 4 jamones.
That's true.
I think your anti-French bias is beginning to shine through here.
No, I love France, Daniele, but what happened in today's stage was this. 215 kilometers from Monaco to Manosque in France started with Pogacar wearing the red jersey. Ethan Vernon was in green. Well, Ethan Hayter was in green instead of Pogacar, and Joshua Tarling led the youth classification. As the peloton approached the rolling hills between Nice and Provence, a few riders went on a breakaway. Koen Bouwman and Diego Uriarte were joined by Ethan Hayter and Sinuhe.
Can far mismo?
Sí. I was there. The peloton was led by Visma Lisebike, Little Trek and Net Company Ineos for the most of the time. Kian Uytebroeks, a common feat here on a cycling podcast, crashed and struggled to hold on in the peloton. He was bruised at the end. Daniele had a bad knee, bloody knee. Kurt Baumann took full points on the 2 third category climbs of the day, L'Alto de Châteauneuf and Col du Sant'Andreo. Spanish names for French climbs, and Kurt Baumann will wear the polka dot jersey tomorrow. For most of the stage, the breakaway's gap was under 2 minutes, and inside the last 50k, it was around 30 seconds. Ethan Hayter attacked from the breakaway, going on a fuga della fuga. Sergio Chumil crashed, became the first rider to abandon the race, unfortunately. Hayter won the intermediate sprint of Greux-les-Bains and took... pronunciation was not fantastic, right? Going, like being?
I mean, it sounded quite Spanish. No, if that's the effect that you're going for.
Hayter took 6 bonification seconds, Van Aert took 4 bonus seconds. Ethan Hayter, soon after that, was caught by the peloton. Things really started to heat up with 2K to go. The first who attacked was Wout Van Aert, Pogacar followed, and with great surprise of yours, Daniele, the third rider who bridged the gap was Astana's Alessandro Romele.
Van Aert's attack, was that around 2.5 to go, 2.9 to go?
I think two, actually.
Okay.
These riders were caught by a little track. Richard Carapaz pulled a bit too. Alessandro Covi tried with a solo attack, but Vismalid's bike with Laporte controlled him, and it came down to an uphill sprint to the line. Finn Fisher-Black opened up the sprint. Pedersen and Pogacar were there contesting it, but it was Matthew Brennan who smoked everyone.
He really did smoke them, didn't he? Like an exocet. Yep. He out Pedersened Pedersen. We know that Pedersen has won in Manos before in the Tour de la Provence, and he made him look, I don't want to say he made him look ordinary, but it was a very, very emphatic first Grand Tour stage win for Matthew Brennan. Of course, this is his first Grand Tour, the rider from Darlington, 21 years of age. He's just turned 21 in August, indeed. Pau Miquel Pellacci was a surprise second place finisher, a surprise to some people, not maybe to the connoisseurs. Tadej Pogacar held on for third place. Some much needed bonus seconds for Pogacar. I'm sure those 4 seconds are going to come in very handy for him later on in the race. Pedersen was just edged out of those bonus seconds. He was fourth. Hugo Hofstetter of NSN was fifth. These riders, of course, all on the same time. Tobias Harland-Johannessen was sixth. That's a very good finish for him. Finn Fisher-Black, you mentioned him doing the lead out. He was seventh. Axel Laurence, who I would suggest might be quite disappointed to have only finished eighth today on a stage in France, on a finish that would certainly have suited him. That's the Net Company Ineos rider. Another Net Company Ineos rider, Oscar Onley, maybe a surprisingly perky ninth place. We're going to hear from Oscar Onley later in the episode. And Luis Aulard of Movistar, 10th. Another rider who might be slightly disappointed to have only finished 10th today. What does that do to the general classification? Well, Pogacar still leads, and he now has a more convincing lead, shall we say, in general classification. Van Aert is second, 9 seconds down. Matthew Brennan is third, 10 seconds down. We've got Leo Bizio of Decathlon, he's fourth, 12 seconds down. And Finn Fisher-Black of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe is in fifth place. He's 14 seconds down. In the points competition, where Pogacar has taken that jersey he had it, didn't he, already?
Yep.
This morning. It was worn, that jersey. It was worn and ripped today by Ethan Hayter because he's in the wrong size. His green jersey, it's more the green shorts that ripped. Incredible Hulk style, Pellacci. Is that before your time? They are, I would say, two sizes too small for him, having seen that up close after the finish. And we might hear him talking about how small that kit is in just a moment. But he's going to wear the green again tomorrow. You mentioned the King of the Mountains. Bauman has that jersey for tomorrow. And Matthew Brennan leads the Young Riders competition. He will be in white tomorrow, won't he? Leo Bisio is second. He's 2 seconds down. Anything else to mention as far as the standings are concerned, Pellacci?
Yeah, let me mention the fact that there was a little gap between the GC favourites, and the likes of João Almeida and Félix Gall were 18 seconds down.
Almeida, who we sort of glossed over yesterday, Pellacci, in our rundown of all the GC riders after the time trial. We didn't mention Almeida yesterday. He was the only one we sort of omitted. But go on, tell me what happened to him today.
They were not able to follow the first big group, of the first bunch, right? They had a big gap, and the likes of Carapaz, the likes of Oscar Onley were able to stay with the first guys. This was not the case with Almeida and
Félix Gall. Yeah. We've got in the second group as well. A couple of other notable names. Luke Tuckwell as well. He's a rider that some people have tipped to have a breakthrough on GC in this Vuelta a España. And can we see any others, Pellacci? Others who'll be licking their wounds tonight?
I was surprised a bit. For example, I was looking at the finish line at Eric Mas. Mas was able to stay in the first group, but he looked gassed. This stage required effort and punching ability from the top guys.
Indeed, indeed, Pilacci. Well, let's hear, as we always do, from some of the protagonists. We've already heard once from Wout van Aert. Let's have a lengthier interview with Wout van Aert. It's Laura Messeger of Eurosport asking the questions in this one. Then you're going to hear me speaking to Pau Miquel, who was second on the stage, and also Ethan Hayter, who, as we mentioned, was in green today and ended up frustrated again. We saw how frustrated he was after the time trial yesterday to lose out so narrowly to Tadej Pogacar, and he ended up, unfortunately, ruining his luck again today.
Wout, clearly the team had two cards. You played them very well. Congratulations for that victory. Tell us, how was that final race?
It was, I would say, like planned. It was my plan to attack there, and a bit of too small of a margin on Tadej, I thought, so I waited a little bit on the top. When they didn't want to give me a turn, I always knew Matthew was there to do a sprint like this, where he's also amazing, and that worked out pretty well, so really proud of the boys today.
Surprise about Matthew, I mean, he's debuting in a Grand Tour, he's so young, and that he could deliver this stage.
Yeah, because of his age is a surprise, but because of what he showed already, it's just almost a normal follow-up, I would say. He's super strong, and he showed it today on the one of the biggest races, so really nice.
I don't even know who was there. I saw Pogacar, but because he's in red, so it's pretty easy to see, but I didn't see Mats. I just closed my eyes. I just pull all the words down, and yeah, second place in the end.
We didn't really know what kind of finish we were going to get. Was it more or less as you expected?
Actually, I was expecting a pretty hectic final. In the end, it wasn't that hectic as I imagined before. Now I'm kind of frustrated, for sure. I want to win as all of us want, so yeah, I'll keep chasing it.
The organization, for some reason, they only gave me an extra small, and then they didn't have any spares, so they said you can wear your own team kit or the green jersey, and I said I can't wear my own team kit, but maybe you never know when your last day is in the jersey. So but then we started the race, and it was like I'm cutting the blood from my legs, so I had to it looked a bit silly, but I was really suffering in the breakaway, and then I started to feel a lot better once I made some breathing room for my legs.
Ethan, how did you try mentally, having been in the break, how did you try to sort of approach the last bit of the race, knowing that, you know, your legs were already suffering probably?
Yeah, when I had to make quite a big effort before I got caught, to be honest, which it was also quite fun, I guess, and I thought, I've been all out all day, I'm not going to go down without a bit of a fight. But then when the bunch caught me, they luckily went, I thought, if they come past and they go for it on this drag, I'm going to be in trouble, but they went quite easy all the way to the finish, really, and I was really hot, obviously, from the effort I just made, and just trying to cool off and recover as much as possible. But those high intensity efforts are quite difficult. If it was just a little bit easier to the finish, it might have been okay. But
obviously, frustrating yesterday, frustrating today. How much would it have changed for you? How much would it have meant for you to take the red jersey?
It would have been really nice, yeah, but I gave it my everything, and maybe I could have crashed into someone and got given the same time, but it's not the way you want to do it, is it? So,
Do you know which stage today reminded me of? Tadej Pogacar.
Go ahead.
2024 Giro d'Italia.
Fossano.
Stage 3, Fossano.
Of
but
course.
I couldn't remember who won that stage. Now, I'll remind the listeners what happened in that stage. There was a bit of a... It looked like a pretty flat stage on paper. In fact, before that Giro d'Italia, we were criticising Mauro Vegni for a boring route. And then I remember, almost on a daily basis in that Giro d'Italia, the Barone, Brian Nygaard and I, our expectations were being exceeded, because every day there was some kind of zampelotto in the finale, and so it proved that day as well. And on that little zampelotto, just outside Fossano, Pogacar attacked with Geraint Thomas and maybe one other.
Pogacar followed an attack by, what's coming up? Pogacar attacked, followed an attack by Michele Onore.
And who won the stage?
I think it was Jonathan Milan.
Ah, okay. Anyway, I was reminded of that today.
Tim Merlier actually did beat Milan that day, but good comparison.
Can you see what I'm getting at? Yeah.
Yeah, perfect.
And one more as well, just quickly. Yeah. The day when Primoz Roglic crashed out of the Vuelta a España in 2022, when he put Remco Evenepoel on the back foot. Remco actually had a sort of dubious puncture around about the 3 kilometres to go mark, and Roglic attacked on the way into, it was a suburb of Sevilla. But then, of course, Roglic slipped with 400 metres to go, and he was out of the Vuelta a España. Remco went on to win. Sorry, Pellacci, carry on.
Yeah, we had a pretty impressive stage finish by Matthew Brandon, right? We saw inside the final kilometer, we were around 500 meters to go. It's not clear the precise location, but Finn Fischer-Black opened up the sprint. Matthew Brandon was in second wheel. He had Mats Pedersen, former world champion, multiple time stage winner at the Grand Tours, on his wheel. Mm-hmm. So he was a predator on Brandon, right? But Brandon was flying up that hill.
Yeah, and they had the perfect configuration for this stage. Those three riders that we mentioned, they were all poised. I mean, individually, well, Van Aert and Laporte might have been slightly disappointed that they didn't take red yesterday, but they were perfectly poised before today's stage. Three guys who ordinarily would be perfectly suited to today's finale, to a sprint in today's finish. But what did that allow them to do? Well, it allowed them to fire Van Aert off down the road with, you were right, 2 kilometres to go. It wasn't 2.9, 2 kilometres to go. And then Brennan was just able to sit in the wheels and sit in Laporte's wheel, particularly Laporte is sacrificing himself. And then, well, Brennan didn't need too much help, did he? You said that he came off Mads Pedersen's wheel, but he didn't even really need to use Mads Pedersen much. And this has been a bit of a characteristic of Matthew Brennan's wins thus far in his very young pro career. I mentioned his age, he's only 21, and he really burst onto the scene a couple of years ago, and this is his first Grand Tour. We've all been excited about what he might achieve here, and there are a lot of stages in this Vuelta which might suit him, and this was really the best version of Matthew Brennan. We don't really know what he is, what he's going to be. There have been comparisons. I think a pretty good comparison is Peter Sagan. Maybe Sagan was a bit more of a climber, but who knows what Brennan is going to become. And Pellacci, we tried to get a bit of a read on what Visma Lisa Bike were going to do with these three riders this morning in Monaco, but as always, that team is very cagey when it comes to revealing tactics in the mix zone to us chumps brandishing microphones. And so it proved this morning as well. They didn't really want to say how they were going to play it, with of course that carrot of the red jersey dangling in front of Wout Van Aert. He's still got a chance. Nine seconds down. Although tomorrow suits Pogacar, and the day after suits Pogacar more than they suit Wout Van Aert.
Daniele, it was already the 20th win of Brennan's career. He was able to find his way in a pretty stacked field in his own team, right? It's not always that you find Laporte, former European champion, as a domestique. Wout Van Aert opening up the gas and leaving Pogacar with less energy in his legs. So, Brennan, I'm impressed again by his conduct in this hectic and twisty final.
Yeah, he seems to be a complete rider in the sense he's a good bike handler. He seems to sit nicely in the wheels. Extremely, extremely fast. I suppose the one question mark we have about him at this point is whether he's going to lean into that ability that he has in sprints. And there have been these sprints that he's won where he's absolutely torched everyone. He's absolutely outclassed everyone. I mean, he almost put 2 seconds into Pedersen today. So we don't know whether he's going to go in that direction. Another point of comparison, I mentioned Sagan, but Jasper Philipsen, to talk of current riders, is another one, maybe partly because of his build and his versatility at this stage. But we shall see. Pellacci, another impressive performance, I thought, today from a UK rider, Ethan Hayter, today. I mentioned his frustration yesterday after the near miss. And to decide that he was not going to bank on bonus seconds, or, well, he ended up getting the bonus seconds, but not out of the peloton anyway, and not going to give it a go in the sprint. Again, we talked briefly yesterday, didn't we, about Hayter and his characteristics, the way his career's gone in the last 2 or 3 years. But it was a very sort of novel tactic that he adopted, a novel idea he had, to get in the break, and then, as you said, the fuga de la fuga. And it was very effective as well, because he got those bonus seconds. It was always going to be tricky for him to hold on, particularly with what we said yesterday in mind, he's a guy who doesn't particularly like technical finales. We drove in the last few kilometers, didn't we? Yep. And it was fiddly, wasn't it, Pelacci? Yeah. And even the best version of Ethan Hayter, even Ethan Hayter, who'd been in the peloton and taking it relatively easily all day, I think would have struggled to be at the pointy end of that today. But a very good performance nonetheless.
In the last 3 or 4K, they rode Nauroad as well. I think what he did was particularly interesting because I think he hoped a bigger breakaway would have gone up the road. If there were 10, 15 riders, he would have spent less energy. And with less energy, he maybe would not have come to the finish line in 80th place, 31 seconds down.
I quite like the fact that he leveraged the Kern Farmismo. He was also in a green jersey as well. Pelacci, one of the many things that occurred to me last night when we weren't recording was, well, to ask you, what is the difference? What would you see as the main differences between Kern Farmismo and Bardianismo?
Well, of course, the main thing is the color, right? They're both green. And they're both...
What are the differences? Not the similarities.
Oh, you said differences. I'm sorry. We are here under the sun in a parking lot in France.
Getting bitten by mosquitoes, yeah.
Not your usual Sunday, but differences...
Or do you want to work on that? Shall I give you a couple of days to work on that?
I think Canapharma has a bigger budget. They have to, right?
Oh, I'm not so sure. Sounds like we need to go away and study this one. Pelacci, back to the race itself. Mm-hmm. Back to the race of the red jersey. Pogacar, well, we didn't need to take today to show us, to prove to us that he's in sparkling form, isn't he?
No, look, I don't know what to say. He's got diamonds in his legs, and he showed that today again. Maybe I thought he had another bang in his legs. When Romele passed his first position under the Flamme Rouge, I thought Pogacar had another explosive attack in his legs. He didn't. Maybe he was playing around and sort of bluffing and looking if Van Aert had something in his hands as well, up his sleeve. He didn't.
Why didn't he commit? We weren't in the press conference. We're not sure what he said about why he didn't commit. But it was sort of uncharacteristic of Pogacar. Usually, he's a born racer. He's an incorrigible racer.
Maybe he knew, Daniele, that if it was down to a sprint between him and Van Aert, it was going to happen Paris-Roubaix again. Van Aert just beating him to the line. I don't know.
Pelacci, Pau Miquel was a surprise for some people, finishing second. We heard from him earlier. Another surprise, and I'm going to unleash you here because you've been champing at the bit, as we say, and you've been scalpitando, as you say in Italian, to talk about Romele, your countryman, Astana rider, who appeared in the show in a similar fashion to Honoré. Michel Honoré in that state that we mentioned to Fossano. We all sort of wondered, who's this third rider in the company of these giants? And it was Alessandro Romele.
It was a bit of a... Remember that Strade Bianche with all the champions plus Michael Gogl?
Who's here at the Vuelta.
Yep, and Romele at the end, a bit of a Ethan Hayter ending for him of a stage because he ended up 93rd. 56 seconds down, but what a display of power he had. He was the only one able to bridge the gap to Van Aert and Pogacar. This guy from Iseo, from the lake in the north, in the Lombardy region, we were talking this morning about how big he is. He's a big ruler, a big sprinter.
Did you talk to him this morning?
He got power. We did.
You talked to him this morning?
Exactly. Okay. I was telling you, Daniele, there is this guy who's showing a lot of promise. We should talk to the guy. We're like, yeah, all right, go ahead.
You did tip Alex Kirsch for the first red jersey of the Vuelta. And he finished where? 57th, did we say?
Not fantastic tip by me, but today I was right. You were wrong. Victory lap for me.
I got seconds after the finish today. I had a WhatsApp message from Pelacci. Pelacci rarely WhatsApps, as I said yesterday. Usually takes him 5 days to respond. I had a message from Block Capitals. You owe me an apology.
First rider under the Flamme Rouge. If the race was 1K shorter, he would have won the stage.
Are we gonna hear what he told you or not?
He said he had a shot at making the team for both the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France to make his GT debut. At the end, he made it only for the Vuelta a España because he was doing good stuff at the Belgium Tour, for example. He called himself a vitello, una ternera, or bull in English.
Yeah.
Because he's big. He's a big rider. Yeah, and we could see him from far away, right? With his light blue jersey. Pretty heavy rider as well, who will suffer a lot at this Vuelta a España. He is foreseeing for himself,
challenging 58,000 meters of climbing coming your way.
Oh, yeah. And interestingly, he said that the best ternera, the best bull in this Vuelta a España is Wout van Aert. They were together in today's final.
Yesterday, we met a sort of bull-like former rider who now cultivates flowers and spoke very romantically about the flowers that he now grows. We're not going to give that away because that has something to do with Tadej Pogacar. There's a link with Tadej Pogacar there as well, but listeners will discover who I'm talking about and what I'm talking about later in the Vuelta a España. Pelacci, anything else you'd like to mention from today's stage? You also spoke to Garofoli Foley this morning.
I did. He said...
Quickstep.
Yeah, he said it's not easy to decide when to go on the breakaway or when not to go. I think this is a reason maybe because of why the breakaway was not that big in numbers today, right? Many riders, I think, many teams thought that today Pogacar and UAE were going to keep the gap closed. Little track, Visma is a bike, did that for them. But he said, Garofoli this morning to me, we have to be able to take whatever he, Pogacar, leaves on the table for us. And at the finish line, I got the chance to talk to overhear what Kian Uytebroeks said to a soigneur. He said, not so good, looking at his elbows and his bloody knee, not looking fantastic for Uytebroeks.
Pelacci, I'm curious to see whether Garofoli's little bit of beef, talking about Ternera, whether his little bit of beef with his teammate Zana continues at this Vuelta a España. We saw at the Giro d'Italia, didn't we, that they weren't necessarily the best of teammates. Early on in the race, we think they patched it up later on, but there was a bit of history to that beef as well, going back several months, even maybe a couple of seasons. Anyway, perhaps we'll have another installment of that at this Vuelta a España. This morning, Pelacci, we had our second consecutive Encuentro del Día with someone from Ineos, or net company Ineos. Yesterday it was Geraint Thomas, we call him the team manager. We still haven't looked up on the website if that's his official title. It might be director of racing. Anyway, everyone knows who Geraint Thomas is. We had him yesterday talking about Josh Tarling's ride in the time trial and just how, well, the team arrived at the decision to bring Josh Tarling here at the Vuelta a España. Today, we had another Ineos victim of the Encuentro del Día. Oscar Only didn't have the best start to the Vuelta a España yesterday. Certainly not as good a start as he had in 2023. You'll remember, Pelacci, that he was part of that, I think it was DSM at the time, they were called DSM Firmenich Team, to everyone's surprise, took the victory in the team time trial in Barcelona, the infamous Remco Evenepoel, what did he say, shitty race like that. Anyway, Only was part of a very young, very green DSM team. They took stage win there, but on the second day of his first Vuelta a España in 2023, he crashed out. So not very good memories of the Vuelta a España for Oscar Only. However, he's starting here as Netcompany Ineos's GC leader, and I spoke to him this morning in Monaco about yesterday and about what he hopes for from these 3 weeks.
El encuentro del día, the meeting of the day.
Well, Oscar, give us a bit of a debrief from yesterday.
Not my best day. Not the TT I would design for myself. So I was expecting to lose time, so it was not really a surprise, to be honest. But the good thing was I felt good on the bits I could push, and I can take some confidence from that.
So we think of you as quite an explosive rider. So just explain why yesterday didn't suit you.
I'm just too slow in the corners, really. I followed Ben and Josh in the recon, and I think I went faster in the recon than in the race. The main goal of yesterday was just to get round and stay upright. So I did that, which is obviously a bonus. Now just looking ahead to the harder stages.
You're obviously in pretty good form based on Burgos, but just tell me how you've sort of structured this summer after you knew that obviously you couldn't ride the Tour de France.
Yeah, I think I changed my focus quite quick. Obviously, I was really disappointed not to be able to do the tour, but I could accept it quite quickly and actually kind of proposed to the team that if I could start the Vuelta, because at the time we didn't really know how the shoulder was going to go, but everything went quite quickly. And yeah, so I had a good camp with the team in Andorra in July, and then obviously Burgos went well as well, so it's given me a lot of confidence.
I'm going to press you, so what's the ambition?
Do the best GC result possible. I think there's some nice opportunities in this race, I think, when we look at the start list compared to the Tour, for example, but really I just need to go through that process and kind of find myself in the race again, because up until Burgos I hadn't really done that this year, so it was nice in Burgos to be able to race at the front and to be aggressive, and I'm kind of hoping to take that into this race as well.
So you haven't really felt in the race so far. I mean, whenever you have raced, you've looked good this year and you've looked as though you've had good form, but I guess a series of setbacks.
Yeah, actually every race I've kind of turned up to in good form, but I've never made it to the mountain stages yet to actually show it. So yeah, I was quite excited in Burgos just to test myself, really, and obviously that went well, and so now I'm confident for this race as well.
And I'm loath to remind you, but your Vuelta career up to now was an interesting one, wasn't it? Because first day, win the team time trial, and the next day you crash out. I'm pretty sure you get further today. I hope so.
Yeah, well, we didn't win yesterday, so hopefully that means we won't repeat what happened on stage two last time. So, no, all good.
It was a fine day. No one crashed. That was good. I think for our team, everyone feels good, and people enjoyed the race around Monaco, so that was cool.
Fabian in a good mood last night. Did he say anything about any interviews he'd done during the day?
Yeah, I think he had nightmares about Daniel Free, but other than that, I think it was good. Yeah.
Hello.
Hello, Umberto. Bonjour, c'est Daniel, le journaliste.
La meilleure dépêche de ma vie s'est passée à Monaco. Je suis pas perdu l'accent italien parce que, rien de vite, on ne regarde plus.
Ah ouais.
I'm here in the backseat of the car, carrying my own business. Oh. And you were chit-chatting it with someone. What was going on there?
Morning, we left Monaco, didn't we? And we know that the national champion of Monaco was sort of on the podium this morning. Their only representative at this level of cycling ever, really, was Victor Longhelotti, who changed teams from Net Company Ineos and before this Vuelta a España. He's in this race. I spoke to him briefly this morning, but we were more curious about his father, weren't we? Because we learned yesterday that his father, well, we knew he was the president of the Monegas Cycling Federation. But we found out yesterday he was born in Naples. His name is Umberto. That's who I was speaking to on the phone as we were driving towards the finish in Manos.
Wow, what a story. I was reading more about UC Monaco Daniele. We could see some riders on the route and just being fans on the park course in Monte Carlo in these days. UC Monaco is famous, actually, a youth club, under 23 racers, they come from there, from Monaco, of course, founded in 1952. The riders come from all over Europe.
Got some Colombians as well.
Wow, interesting, correct. In fact, their sort of last high-profile rider they produced was Brandon Rivera, and until last season, Egan Bernal's young brother.
Palacio, do you want to know what Umberto told me?
Go ahead.
He lived in Naples until the age of 18. At that age, his parents separated. His dad remained in Naples. His mum went to Monaco. I didn't actually find out why his mum went to Monaco. That was kind of a key detail that I omitted to
not,
ask
not
him about.
Periodismo,
not
Daniel.
Fantastic journalismo from me. But his mother went to Monaco. His sister, or sisters perhaps, they stayed in Naples. He still visits. He still goes once a year. But Umberto stayed in Monaco. Says he's still got a lot of friends in Naples. Still speaks with a Neapolitan accent when he speaks Italian. I didn't even detect too much of a Neapolitan accent in his French. Worked, Pelacci, for as the head of accounting for the Monaco National Council, the Monegasque Parliament, until 3 years ago. And he's now officially retired, but obviously he has this fairly important and prestigious sort of side hustle, if we could call it that, as the president of the Monaco Federation. When we first heard about Victor Longhelotti, when he was riding for Burgos Biache a few years ago, we heard about this period in his life where he became quite overweight and he became addicted to video games. And I seem to remember that it was FIFA, particularly the game he was addicted to. I asked Umberto, was he aware of this addiction? He said no, he'd left home at that point, he was doing it in secret. But then one day he called his father and he said, Dad, we need to get rid of all of the computers, or I'm done with computers. I'm going to get rid of them from my life and I'm going to concentrate on cycling. Umberto said you could kind of tell that his training wasn't maybe at the level that it should have been because he wasn't performing. And that was why he was spending too much time on FIFA. Umberto himself, not a big video games guy. He didn't partake in the FIFA.
I have the same addictions to Victor Longhelotti, Daniele, cycling and FIFA. But listen, we're getting closer and closer.
Pelacci, welcome to part three. This is the interactive part of the cycling podcast. But before we get to the questions, because we're premiering some new technology today, we don't know whether it's going to work or not. Let's keep our fingers crossed. The drive to Manosque today, Pelacci, you were sitting back, you had your chef's hat on, you swore that the kitchen was open and the oven was on today. So what were you cooking on the back seat?
I was just reading about Manosque and Provence and all of the lavender fields and what was going on in the tiny villages around. Daniele, where do we want to start?
Well, what have you? We talked yesterday about Jean Genot, the famous author from Manosque. What did you find out about Jean Genot today? Incidentally, it was about 3 kilometers to go, wasn't it? The peloton was on the Avenue de Jean Genot. That wasn't exactly where Wout van Aert launched his attack.
His father, Daniele, had Piedmontese origins from Italy, of course, and the part of Italy that's most close to France in the northwest part of Italy. He took part as a soldier in the Verdun Battle. It was a huge battle in the First World War. That happened exactly 100 years ago. There are a couple of quotes that I read down from The Man Who Planted Trees, one of his most famous novellas. And another one is A King Alone, or as it was the original title, it was un roi sans divertissement, a king without enjoyment. Yeah. Maybe what Pogacar is in this Vuelta a España, we'll see, in the following stages.
He looks like he's having a good time at the moment. We'll see. Actually, incidentally, people who are keen followers of social media, the modern phenomenon known as social media, might be aware that there was a little bit of beef, to use that word again, a bit of controversy today about an influencer. This is your department now, that has been hired apparently by the Vuelta a España to make content here at the race. And yesterday this influencer sort of she approached Pogacar when he was waiting to go onto the podium to collect his jersey. The whole thing, we might get into it in the next couple of days, because I think it's a really interesting conversation about the way races are covered and the role for dinosaurs like me, the role for young bucks like you, and also something very interesting and I think very right that one of our colleagues I mentioned, I think earlier in the podcast, Laura Messeguer, wrote on social media. But this is a conversation we're going to get into in the next few days. Pelacci, where was I going with that? I just did want to mention as well something we referenced in the podcast yesterday. Eric Carritu, the winner of the closest ever Grand Tour.
Wow.
He won the 1984 Vuelta a España by just 6 seconds. And why did I mention him yesterday? Why am I talking about him today? Because he hails from just down the road, or up the road from here, a village called Flesson. And he had this lifelong, it's very interesting, lifelong connection with Mont Ventoux. was born in the Ventoux Shadow in Carpentras, lived in the in the Ventoux Shadow his whole life. We talked about the vineyard that he had with his brother, again in the shadow of the Ventoux, and was discovered thanks to a victory in the Tour de Vaucluse on the Ventoux. I think he beat Laurent Fignon. Then he just kept winning on Ventoux. He won in Paris on Ventoux. I think he won in the Tour de France on Ventoux. Anyway, Pellacci, he was only really at the 1984 Vuelta a España. He was certainly only the leader of the skill team because Sean Kelly had a very busy spring winning everything. And he was supposed to do the Vuelta, but they pulled him out at the last minute. Jean de Gribaldi, the director of that team, called for Caritou. And they sent him to a Vuelta that was beginning in Jerez de la Frontera in Andalusia. And an interesting battle ensued with the various Spanish contenders for that Vuelta a España, particularly Perico Delgado and Alberto Fernández. Fernández was riding for the Zor team. But before that, Francesco Moser, your countryman, had taken the first amarillo, first yellow jersey of the race in the first stage. He held the jersey for about a week. And then Caritou, this unknown Frenchman that all the Spanish riders in the Spanish press throughout that Vuelta, they just kept referring to as the French guy, the French dude. He won a stage in Catalunya to a place called Rasos de Perguera. Caritou later on in the race, a few days later, took the amarillo jersey off Perico Delgado, and it all came down to the penultimate day. There were two stages that day. This used to happen in the in Grand Tours. Sometimes they would have semi-stages. There was a mountain stage and a time trial. And at the end of those two stages, Alberto Fernández wasn't able to oust Eric Caritou, who went on the next day in Madrid to win the Vuelta a España by just 6 seconds. And he went on to have a good career, but not a spectacular career. It was certainly the only Grand Tour that he ever won. Incidentally, Pellacci, Alberto Fernández, this was in 1984 I'm talking about, in the December of 1984, Alberto Fernández and his wife died in a car accident.
No.
Yes, and he was aged just, I think, 29 or 30 at the time. And since 1984, 1985, the organization of La Vuelta have attributed the Alberto Fernández Prize in the same way that the organizer of the Giro d'Italia give the Cimacopi Prize, and in the Tour de France is the Desgranges Memorial Prize. It's not always the highest climb in the Vuelta, it's a prestigious summit. And this year, it's going to be given to the first rider to the top of the Collado de Alguacil on the penultimate day, which is going to be the last big climb of the Vuelta a España. So that's Eric Caritou. I hoped we might see him at the finish today, but we didn't bump into him. That was not very interactive.
Good story. We went from Lavender to World War One to the tour in the 80s. Ciao, amico. And we're live, we're interactive, we are saluting people, we say ciao ciao to everybody, right?
Exactly. Should we get to something interactive?
Let's go.
Well, Pellacci, this is using a new technology recently rolled out. We now have an account. I think Lionel did this, the same platform during the Tour de France. SpeakPipe now. This entails us posting a link in various places where you might see it, clicking on this link, and the chaps at SpeakPipe will give you the opportunity to record a voice message. And one of the early adopters is a gentleman called Eamon, who sent us this message earlier today.
What is the Spanish equivalent of ciclissimo?
Pellacci, a question for you. What is the difference between, well, in Italian it's ciclismo, in Spanish it's ciclismo.
Not many differences.
No, it's the more or less difference between ciclismo and ciclismo than there is between Kern Farm and Bardiano.
Good question. I think, well, Italians are brothers of the world, right?
Mm.
But more so, we are brothers with our Spanish friends. I think there are not many differences at all.
Mm.
I think what we love about ciclismo is grassroots aspect. The fact that riders are going 100% every day, how people, you know, they just fight for the love of it. They don't care about results or saving energy. They don't do that. They give 100% every day. That's ciclismo. That's ciclismo as well in Spanish. And at the end of the day, you've got Tinto de Verano to close it off, right?
Tinto di Verona is like squash. It's like wine squash.
It's like Lambrusco. The Spanish version of Lambrusco,
I suppose not quite as noble as Lambrusco, I wouldn't say. But so anyway, yeah, I get where you're coming from. We won't discuss the differences between ciclismo, ciclismo and French panache.
Yeah.
Because that's a different conversation. Yeah. Panache is a little bit snootier and a little bit sort of, you know, more grandiose, isn't it? But yeah, in common, the Spanish and the Italians have the fact that they hate the French as well. But actually, you have another question sent in the analog way. I think this was a question on Strava from who?
From Mr. Tish de Jong. He asks, Daniele, what is your favorite or five-star paellas? Five paellas edition equivalent to the Tour de France 2003 with the five glasses of wine that you hand out.
I don't have such a photographic memory, although I've covered on the ground now all the Vueltas from end to end since 2016, and I've been to the Vuelta obviously sporadically before that. I don't have
in the 80s and the 90s as well.
Shut up. I don't have such a photographic memory of all these editions of the Vuelta a España. However, there have been some good ones. Pelacci, I mentioned to you how well poised the 2014 edition was when we went up to Ancares on the penultimate stage, and the fact that four riders looked as though really they could have won the Vuelta a España that day: Alejandro Valverde, Chris Froome, Alberto Contador, and Joaquin Rodriguez. That morning, and it's a beautiful, beautiful location, Ancares, it really did look as though any of those four could win that Vuelta a España. In the end, it was Contador. That certainly gave that Vuelta a España a certain luster. Even before that, we had Fuente de Contador's masterpiece in 2012. That was another classic, but I'm talking about stages, single stages here. Again, 2015, when Aru took the jersey off Tom Dumoulin, a very dramatic denouement to that Vuelta a España. But I really enjoyed, and I would have to go back and look at each of the individual stages, but certainly I have very fond memories of the 2020 Vuelta. To be honest, Pelacci, I have very fond memories of all the Grand Tours in that year, because it was such a strange year to be working on the races, and we felt so lucky to be there. And there were a lot of things that were just different, and there was also a generation of riders emerging that seemed different. They seemed to interpret cycling in a different way. And the one thing I also remember about that Vuelta a España in 2020 was really interesting fights for the minor jerseys, the minor prizes, for the breakaways as well. And I think also that aspect of racing that year, particularly the Grand Tours, and especially that Vuelta, you didn't know how far the race was going to go. And we really did feel there were various times in that race where we thought this was going to be the last day. And that lent a sort of urgency to the racing, which I really enjoyed. So I have very fond memories of that. Whether it was, probably not five paellas, but maybe four.
That's super interesting. In that year, 2020, Enric Mas won the youth classification. Time flies.
Enric Mas, he's a demon when it comes to the Vuelta a España. He's an absolute demon. Pelacci, let's talk about tomorrow's stage when we are not leaving France. We're still going to be in France.
La etapa de mañana y asuntos varios. Tomorrow's stage and any other business.
Pelacci, this rubric of the podcast has changed. We no longer necessarily talk about last night's dinner. However, since we were dining in Italy and it was a very good dinner, you have my permission to talk about last night's dinner or something else.
Oh, I was eating like a king last night, Daniele. We had brandacoyun. It's a typical dish of Liguria, made up with potatoes and bacala.
Cod.
Yes, fantastic stuff. As a primo, I had a pasta. Lovely pasta with
pasta?
Just tagliatelle al ragù. Very basic.
We're in pesto country. I had a fantastic pesto, deep green. And one thing, maybe I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but Liguria, where pesto is from, what you'll often find in the pesto, and you don't find this outside Liguria, is you'll often get, what do you call it, green beans and potato in pesto, which I had last night, and it was delicious.
It's true.
Glass of pigato as well, white wine, lovely fresh white wine we had last night.
Nebbiolo
and
as well?
Ligurian wine we had,
red wine or Nebbiolo. But French autogrills that we had today on the roof.
Let's not talk about them. That is a very, very sore subject. That's a very sore subject.
I don't know what to say.
Pelacci, tomorrow's stage, we're going to Font-Romeu in the Pyrenees.
Yeah, still in France. We'll start from France again, from the Narbonnaise area.
Yeah.
French is not my language, Daniel.
No, it's brilliant. You're speaking English with a French accent now. It adds extra flavor to the podcast. Wonderful, Pelagio.
It will be 175 kilometers. The first 120, more or less, will be around 0 meters above sea level, Daniele. Then we'll climb it up until almost 2,000 to Font-Romeu. That's correct.
And actually, can you just mention, because it was important today, where the intermediate sprints are tomorrow? Because it could be important again tomorrow.
There will be only one in Villefranche de Confiens with around 45 kilometers to go.
What's that B on the top of the first category climb? Is that
it's
bonus
a bonus sprint,
well?
Exactly. On Col de Mont-Louis, which ends with around 18.
So no bonus seconds at the first first of those sprints that you mentioned, but there are six bonus seconds, 6, 4, 2 at the second one.
And then the final climb to Font-Romeu starts. It's not a tough climb, right? It's 10K, 5% gradient as an average. How do you go away from Pogacar as the favorite?
Well, I don't think you do, Pelacci. This was one of the stages we predicted that he would win in the preview episode, and I haven't changed my prediction. Certainly nothing we've seen over the last few days has changed my feelings about that. I noticed some of our colleagues have started to talk about this Vuelta a España in terms of, well, the Vuelta minus Pogacar. They're completely excluding him from their discussions. For example, about yesterday's TT, only comparing sort of like for like in inverted commas. And actually, you know, I said a lot of the GC guys had poor time trials yesterday, and I was thinking in terms of the distance to Pogacar, but when you compared them amongst themselves, Felix Gal versus Carapaz versus Only, it was pretty close. And I expect it to be close between those guys tomorrow. I mean, I don't think Pogacar's going to take a minute tomorrow. He's not. But at the very least, I think he's going to be the fastest in the last 500 metres, in the same way that he was at Les Angles in the sort of analogous stage of the Tour de France. And Pelacci, I promise you that I had a lot of... I did a lot of research on Font-Romeu, the French mecca of altitude training. I'm not going to share all of that with the listeners now because we're probably already running quite long with this episode. But just to say, this is a destination, a Pyrenean resort, I suppose you could call it, that has become synonymous with endurance sport and altitude training. This came about, Pelacci, because the French... You would have been rejoicing if you'd been alive in 1964, because the French did very badly at the Tokyo Olympic Games. And ahead of the Mexico Olympic Games, which were going to be held at altitude, Charles de Gaulle himself, he was involved in some fashion with the Minister of Sports, Maurice Herzog. They decided that they were going to create some sort of centre of excellence for French athletes at altitude. And they did build such a place at 1,850 metres. I think Mexico City is just over 2,000. Anyway, the French did go on to do very well, in no small part thanks to the training that their athletes had done at Font-Romeu. They won 15 medals, including 7 golds. But maybe we'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow. I've driven through Font-Romeu, never stopped there. So it should be interesting. Look forward to it. Pelacci.
Just a correction corner right away.
Go
Did
on.
You say Emil Herzog?
No, Maurice Herzog.
Maurice Herzog. Both Herzogs are less famous than...
Werner Herzog.
Of course.
Yeah, he had nothing to do with the high altitude training center.
My dream, Daniele, is to compile a list of the best three Fernandez or Rodriguez that ever rode a bicycle.
Do you have a favorite Werner Herzog film or documentary?
I don't like
Grizzly Man is a good one.
Wow. Interesting.
I would recommend.
Going sideways.
As we go into the Pyrenees, and famously, there are lots of bears in the Pyrenees. Anyway, Pelacci, we'll be back tomorrow.
Yeah. Let's go.
Bonsoir à toi.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burns.